One of the most infamous comments of the Bush administration so far came from Alberto Gonzalez, now the U.S. Attorney General. He was the one who referred to the Geneva Convention as quaint. Whatever the context of his remark, he was taken to mean that it's rather quaint to think of coddling suspected terrorists when there's information to be extracted from them. Since 9/11, terror suspects have been subjected to many kinds of coercive interrogations at the hands of U.S. intelligence officers. They include sexual humiliation. We saw this in the photos from Abu Ghraib. Suspects have been handcuffed in uncomfortable positions for hours on end, and some have been subject to waterboarding, a method that simulates the feeling of drowning. Some suspects have even been sent to foreign countries where torture is commonly used. Last week, Congress voted to outlaw torture in the treatment of terror suspects, but we're still not quite sure what that means. We're going to spend some time talking about the many aspects of the torture debate, and we begin by talking about the political end of it with Carol Kennedy. Carol is a professor of political science at San Diego State University. She focuses on American presidential and electoral politics. And Carol, thanks for coming in.
I'm glad to be here.
Listeners, you can call us at 888-895-5727. That's 888-895-KPBS. Also, your emails are welcome. You can send us an email at thesedays@kpbs.org. Carol, congressional leaders signed the Detainee Treatment Bill on Friday to deal with interrogations and trials of terrorism suspects. And we heard a little bit about this in our Capitol Hill update, but you spent the weekend reading this bill, which is 94 pages. And why don't you tell us a little bit about the bill and what you think it changes?
Well, excuse me, the bill itself is indeed very extensive. And a lot of the interpretations and a lot of the discussion about the bill are really not very sophisticated in terms of the complexity of the bill. Some of the major changes that are introduced in the Military Commissions Act of 2006 is a very broad and expansive definition of enemy combatants. There's a lot of concern by legal scholars that this broad definition could lead to even American citizens being designated enemy combatants and being subject to the requirements of this law. The bill also repudiates a half century of international precedent by allowing President Bush to decide on his own what abusive interrogation methods he considers permissible. There is a modification to the War Crimes Act of 1996. The habeas corpus provision is stripped for all enemy combatants. And again, that could include the designation of American citizens as enemy combatants. There's no judicial review. The rules of evidence are going to allow coercive interrogation testimony to be admitted. And there is a tremendous amount of vague provisions in the bill that are subject to interpretation by the president and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld.
Let me go back to something you said. You said that it would be up to the president to decide what kinds of, quote, abusive interrogation methods would be used. And it's interesting that you put it that way because I believe the bill specifically outlaws torture, but is it your opinion that it does allow what you call abusive interrogation techniques?
What the bill does is specify specific items that would constitute torture. It's very reminiscent of several of the Department of Justice memos that were leaked in the 2002 era, in which Alberto Gonzalez and John Yoo, counselors to the president, attempted to dumb down the definition of torture or torture the definition of torture to the point where anything that the president wanted to do would not be considered torture. We see the same kind of rationale coming again in this bill.
I see. Well, let's talk about some methods of interrogation, that some of which I mentioned in my introduction. And let me ask you whether you think that they would be legal under this bill. What about waterboarding?
That's a very good question. Stephen Hadley, who's the Deputy Secretary of Defense, was asked that very question on a discussion board on the National Review, and he refused to rule out waterboarding. He insisted that the president would not discuss specific interrogation techniques. And so you have an administration official specifically refusing to rule out waterboarding. Senator John McCain has claimed that this bill does make waterboarding illegal. Again, it is subject to interpretation, and the president gets to be the ultimate arbiter of what it means.
It's interesting that John McCain was involved in this discussion because this is a guy who was held by the Viet Cong for 5 years, I think. He was a prisoner of war. He was subject to torture himself. And I guess some people would argue that that reason alone, given that he was one of the backers of this bill, that that gives it a certain amount of integrity. What do you think? What do you think of his involvement in this bill?
No, I think he was spurred to involvement when Colin Powell sent him a letter on September 13th indicating that he felt that this legislation or the proposed legislation was going to lead to a decline in the moral basis of the United States. Unfortunately, my interpretation of the bill over the weekend concludes or at least shows to me that this compromise was not a compromise at all, that essentially the president got virtually everything that he wanted in this bill, and that the phrasing of the bill and the wide variety of provisions in the bill are subject to interpretation, and ultimately that interpretation is left to one man, the president of the United States.
What about holding people in uncomfortable positions? What about light deprivation or darkness deprivation, where the lights, blazing lights, are on all the time? What about the use of loud blaring music? All acceptable under this bill, in your opinion?
Absolutely not prohibited specifically in this bill. Therefore, I would assume the president would claim that those are still acceptable methods.
And I've been speaking with Carol Kennedy, professor of political science at San Diego State University. She's going to be taking part in a SDSU teach-in entitled Historical, Political, and Moral Dimensions of the U.S. Torture Debate that takes place this afternoon at 3 o'clock. Join us if you would like by calling 888-895 KPBS, let us know if you think the torture is ever justified. And let me now move on to another guest who's also going to be part of this teach-in. His name is Brian Loveman, and he's a professor of political science and past Fred J. Hansen Chair of Peace Studies at San Diego State University. Brian, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for inviting me.
Brian, let's talk about American history. Has torture been used in this country in the past?
The United States has supported torture, carried out torture, supported governments that carried out torture systematically since World War II.
Well, I know that we've supported countries that use torture, but you say that the U.S. has used and condoned torture. Can you give us an example?
The United States supported torture throughout Latin America from the 1960s on. The United States helped to organize Operation Condor. The United States sent advisors and technicians to assist with torture in Uruguay, in Chile, in Brazil, in other countries, in Paraguay.
What about American officials, American intelligence officers using torture against people who are in American custody? Is that part of our history as well?
Absolutely. During the Vietnam War, those large-scale torture, assassination teams, a large-scale program, the Phoenix program, even had a quota for numbers of people who should be arrested, detained, and eliminated during the 1960s.
Are we talking about American citizens here or citizens of other countries?
Both American citizens and allies.
As you can see, I'm drawing somewhat of a distinction between America supporting torture that is done by other countries and America supporting torture in a way that might violate our Constitution. We have a Constitution that says that America cannot use cruel and unusual punishment. Do you feel that that has been violated?
Absolutely. The United States is signatory to a number of international laws and treaties. Those have been systematically violated by American policy.
Let's talk about this expression, enemy combatants. What does that mean to you, Brian? We talk about an enemy combatant as opposed to a prisoner of war, what is that?
It's an invented term. Particularly unlawful enemy combatant is an invented term. It's a linguistic device intended to avoid international law and U.S. law. I believe that the U.S. military is very poorly served by this. I think American officers understand they're poorly served by it. And I think that Colin Powell's recent statements have made clear that he opposed the legislation that was passed.
Does this expression have a history that extends beyond the past 5 years, since 2001?
The particular term unlawful enemy combatant?
Or enemy combatant, yeah.
Well, enemy combatant is just a term of war. It's just there are enemy combatants, people who are fighting against us.
Right, but is this something that we have used, and maybe you can answer this question, Carol, is this an expression that has been used prior to 9/11/2001 as a way to describe people who have a certain legal status?
Actually, the use of the term enemy combatants is part of the Geneva Conventions, which requires that they be afforded the common Article 3 protections. The president has designated individuals unlawful enemy combatants for the express purpose of exempting them from coverage by the Geneva Conventions or the War Crimes Act. So, no, the unlawful enemy combatants is an invention of this administration.
And Carol, do you feel that this legislation that was passed by Congress violates the Geneva Convention?
What it does is it tries to interpret the Geneva Conventions, and it does so rather broadly. And then it goes on to say that nothing in the act, nothing in the bill restricts the president's authority to interpret the Geneva Conventions in any way that he chooses to do so.
And with that, I'm Tom Fudge. My guests are Carol Kennedy and Brian Loveman. And now we're going to introduce another guest, Tom Weston. He's a professor of logic, ethics, and political philosophy at San Diego State. He's also taking part in the teach-in this afternoon. And Tom, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Well, Tom, is torture ever justified?
I think the answer is no, simply. That is that one of the jobs that moral philosophers sometimes do is to try to think up extreme cases where things that are otherwise unjustified might be justified. That is, I think if I took a little while longer than we would want to take, I'd try to find a case where murder of an innocent person is actually justified. But those are cases which, if they ever occur at all, are extremely rare. And I think that that would be the kind of position that we should have about torture, that we could dream up cases where it might seem to be justified, but if they ever occur, it would be rare. And it certainly should not be the basis for making up laws or any other policies.
Well, when you say it's unjustified, unjustified on what basis? Because I suppose I could make an argument, and I don't know if this would be true. There are a lot of people who say that you know, information that you get through torture is very unreliable when you get right down to it. But let's say I made an argument, and it was a convincing argument, that in some situations, use of torture can get information that could save the lives of hundreds of people. In a situation like that, would it be justified?
Well, I'm not aware, actually, of any cases where this actually occurs. The administration sometimes claims that they get valuable information from torture, but usually it means that they catch someone that they want for some purpose or other. That their position seems to be, and sometimes the people who are defendants for people charged as enemy combatants have raised this question, that they can boil people in oil if they wish. That is, that there are no limits to the kind of suffering that they can inflict on people, not just as punishment, but even as a means to obtain some U.S. policy goal, which may or may not be obtained by it. And in fact, I think most of the discussion of the critics of torture in the Congress have been in the terms of why this is rather bad public relations for the United States, because it tends to produce lots of hatred and may, in fact, produce much greater resistance to the policies of the United States as it attempts to occupy Iraq or dominate other countries. And that's not, as far as I'm concerned, the moral basis for opposing torture. That is, that it's bad public relations. It's there are some limits to the degree to which a person can be used, that each person has what moral philosophers call a dignity, meaning they have a certain status that accords them some rights, and that those rights can't be trampled on simply for some advantage. And, of course, often in the cases we're talking about, it's quite imaginary advantage.
Sorry to interrupt, but what is torture?
That the statute the treaty that defines this describes it as infliction of cruelty or suffering, and also adds it as something in addition to this inhuman or degrading treatment in order for a variety of purposes, for punishment, for intimidation, or for information. And the treaty that the United States has signed, and they have made some reservations, but they're rather minor, outlaws this in all cases. And, of course, the Army has an interrogation manual which also outlaws all such kinds of procedures. And the Bush administration suspended this several years ago. And then we just saw here when the budget bill was being debated, the so-called McCain Amendment was to reaffirm that the interrogation procedures would be those of the manual, which I haven't read this manual, it's classified, but which by all accounts accords with the Geneva Accords.
Well, let's I'm sorry, go ahead and finish your sentence.
But I think that the Bush administration is, in fact, very committed to torture procedures. And according to the Financial Times report last week, the reason they stopped the special CIA prisons and transferred some of the al-Qaeda suspects to Guantanamo is because the interrogators refused to interrogate anymore because they were afraid that they would be subject to criminal prosecution either in the United States or in Europe.
And let's take a call from Kevin in downtown San Diego. Kevin, go ahead. You're on the show.
Hi, Tom. This is Kevin Keenan. I'm the executive director of the ACLU here in San Diego. I wanted to commend you for the program. I think my contribution is just that the Bush administration has really outdone itself, and not just the regular old abuses and laws that violate civil liberties, which every power and every government and every presidential administration has, but in tackling some legal institutions that we have long held sacred, the Geneva Conventions, prohibition against torture, and the writ of habeas corpus, which goes back to the Magna Carta. And I just wanted to add, too, that there are Democrats who think that this is just a Republican thing, and I think it's worth pointing out that the vote in the Senate was 65-34 in support of this law. The ACLU plans to sue as soon as the president signs this awful, awful bill.
Okay, you're going to sue on what basis, Kevin?
A violation of the Geneva Conventions, violation of separation of powers, a variety. I mean, this will be a long complaint.
All right, thanks very much. You're listening to These Days. We need to take a break. When we return, we'll be back with our guests and with our callers talking about the subject of torture. Give us a call. Let us know whether you think the torture is ever justified. 888-895-KPBS. Reza is on the freeway. Go ahead. You're on the show.
Hello to everybody. I just wanted to make a comment about something that really changed my viewpoint on how I thought of the whole war on terror processes, and including torture. And recently I saw a documentary, which was about an hour and some minutes long. It was on the internet, and it really outlined the combatants and what happened at 9/11. The way I came about it was I went to Google Video and I typed in 9/11 cover-up, watched the video, and it's really changes the foundation of the war on terror and all of the topics that go along with it. I would encourage anybody who wants to form an opinion on this to watch such a documentary if they wish to and form their own opinion about it. But to me, basically, the bottom line of it was that there was irrefutable evidence that that the events that occurred on that day was not as the government was wanting us to believe. And I know there's lots of conspiracy theories out there, but this was definitely one that it seemed really solid, and I would encourage everyone to make their own opinion on that.
All right. Thank you very much, Reza. Let's take another call. We've got Michael on the line from downtown San Diego. Michael, go ahead.
Yeah, I was listening, and I'm a long-time listener. I seem to be confused as to where the administration is not supporting the troops. I personally don't have a problem with interrogation methods. Not to say that I condone torture or anything like that, but I believe there's information that is necessary to the defense of this country. However, what seems to happen is the people who are on the ground extracting information and doing their job seem to have been abandoned by the higher levels of government. As to say, if they were given orders to torture an individual or perform aggressive interrogations, as they call it, that kind of order gets backtracked all the way up the chain of command until it gets to someone who has the ability to say, we don't condone that sort of behavior. It seems to me that just, our troops on the ground are basically being left hung out to dry by our administration, who is refusing to support our troops in questionable command decisions.
Michael, have you been involved in interrogations in the military?
I'm former Marine Corps, and I understand the process of where these orders come from. I'm not in intelligence, which would allow for extraction of information of that sort. But I understand where these orders come from.
Before I let you go, Michael, you said that you do accept the idea that aggressive interrogation is okay as long as it's not torture. Is that the kind of thing that folks in the Marine Corps and Marine Intelligence, Army Intelligence, do you think that they can draw that line?
No, what I meant by that was I don't have a problem with individuals doing what they're ordered to do in order to defend this country. I would like to make the distinction that these individuals don't take it upon themselves to torture or aggressively interrogate anyone without authorization. And it seems as though the people in positions to give authorization to do this are abandoning the individuals doing it.
All right. Thank you very much, Michael. And Tom, maybe this is one you should respond to, because he seems to bring up the question of whose responsibility it is, the person who establishes the policy or the person who carries it out.
Well, I think that it's pretty clear from the information that was given to interrogators that they were no longer subject to the Army Manual or to Geneva Accords, that they were simply set free to do whatever they thought was useful to do. And so, of course, we've had a number of people in Iraq who were beaten to death. We've had a number of other people. You saw the pictures for Abu Ghraib, were treated in a humiliating and painful way. And of course, we have also the long-term policy to send people to other governments who are going to do the actual torturing. We've had a couple of cases here of a German national who was kidnapped by the CIA and sent to Afghanistan and tortured, and that of a Canadian national who was deported to Syria with so-called rendering in order to be tortured.
Right, but let me get back to my question. My question was, we have a person in Abu Ghraib, and we have the photographs, we know who these people are, who conducted these interrogations, used sexual humiliation and whatever it was, and those people have been prosecuted. What about the people who condoned it or who may have given the order? I mean, who is more at fault?
Well, I think that General Miller, who used to be in charge in Abu Ghraib in Guantanamo, has moved to Abu Ghraib. After he came to Abu Ghraib, the interrogations, by all accounts, became much nastier and more likely to use dogs and other, torture means. And that the administration has simply decided they're going to give that guy a pass. And I think it makes sense for them to do that, because I think he's simply following their policy. Their policy is to torture people when they think it has some advantage.
Brian,
and the fact that may be a violation of international human rights standards and treaty obligations of the United States doesn't seem to bother them very much.
Brian Loveman, anything you want to say on this point?
Yeah. I think we have to take into account we have a highly professional military, that within the military there is a legal corps which has resisted these tendencies on the part of the administration. These orders initiate with civilian leaders out of the Defense Department and out of the Attorney General's office. But within the military, there is a concept of unlawful order, and military officers and enlisted personnel at all ranks have an obligation not to obey unlawful orders. Unlawful orders would include violations of U.S. law, violations of the Uniform Military Code of Justice, and international law insofar as it's law within the United States. And, of course, international treaties signed by the United States do become domestic law. So on all those accounts, military officers and enlisted personnel are obligated not to follow unlawful orders. And the people who give those orders, whether in uniform or in the White House or in the Defense Department or anywhere else in the United States government, including the Central Intelligence Agency, are committing crimes punishable under U.S. law and international law.
Do you think they realize that? Do you think that people in the military understand that?
I think there's a number of people in the military who have made this case. I highly respect our military, and I have a number of ex-students in the field now in important positions. And, of course, I won't put their names out on the radio, but many of them strongly oppose current policy.
Let's go to Stephen in Chula Vista. Stephen, go ahead. You're on These Days.
Hi. I was wondering if I could hear a better explanation of what waterboarding is, because I've seen descriptions and they said that cellophane would be put over the face of the subject, but I'm not sure if that's to, if that's supposed to cover the face from the water or if it's supposed to hold the water so that then that the person has to inhale it.
Okay, thank you, Stephen. My understanding is that it involves a board and makes you feel like you're drowning. Can you add anything to that, Brian Loveman?
There are many torture techniques. I don't think this is an appropriate venue in which to describe torture techniques and how to carry them out. Waterboarding is one of many techniques which simulates drowning and asphyxiation and therefore is torture.
All right. Carol, do you care to add anything to that?
There have been a number of efforts.
I mean, with all due respect to our guest, Brian, he says it's not appropriate, but maybe it is. Maybe it is appropriate to describe exactly what's going on.
Well, as Brian mentioned, there are a number of different ways in which this technique can be utilized. It has been utilized in Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge regime. There are some photographs available on the internet. There's a museum that has the actual original waterboarding machinery. It's a board, and the person is water's poured on their face. They can't breathe. They think they're dying.
And Carol Kennedy is a professor of political science at San Diego State. My guests are also Brian Loveman, who's also in political science, and he's a former Fred J. Hansen chair of peace studies at San Diego State. And Tom Weston is a professor of logic, ethics, and political philosophy. 888-895-KPBS. And Tom?
Well, the Convention on Torture and Degrading and Inhumane Treatment forbids both physical and psychological tortures. I think waterboarding is an interesting case that would fall into both categories. That is, psychological tortures, for example, would be things like mock executions. And this is a situation where the person is made to believe that they will die. And it is not. This is not a new invention, incidentally. There was agitation during the Spanish-American War that the Americans were using this as a technique to torture Filipino rebels in 1898. It's not a new invention, but that it does appear to be something new, that it be something which is sort of permitted by the officials of the administration rather than something that's carried out in a semi-secret way, or, you know, let your allies do it instead of do it yourself. There's a new height of degradation which is being reached here in the use of torture rather than it be something that's a secret and not acknowledged.
Tom, let me get back to this question of whether torture is ever justified, because again, you could come up with an argument saying that if we use coercive interrogation against this person, if we torture this person, we could save lives. Now, I think there are differing opinions on that. Most people that I have read say that it doesn't do any good. They'll just lie to make the pain stop. But if you can, in a situation, use torture to get valuable information that would save lives, if you want to get really nasty, you could say to somebody, if you don't tell us where this bomb is going to go off, we're going to kill your family. I mean, there are all sorts of horrible things that one could do that could save lives and, you know, in some kind of utilitarian calculation, be the right thing to do. But are you saying that once we do that, we lose our soul, we lose track of who we are as dignified human beings? Is that the argument against this?
Well, I'm not trying to make the argument mainly that this is something that it's disadvantageous to the United States or to its officers or military personnel, that they're going to become degraded. The main harm that's done to the people who are victims. I don't think you should imagine that people who get tortured are people who all have guilty knowledge of some explosion that's about to be going off. We're certain from the people that we have be able to interview from Abu Ghraib or from Guantanamo or other places they've been tortured, that many people are tortured when they knew nothing and had no responsibility for any wrong action for which this would be a punishment. And of course, it would be an immoral punishment in any case, right? That I think the Constitution is perfectly right when it forbids cruel and inhuman punishments. But now we're talking about cruel and inhuman treatment of a person who, as far as the torturer knows, does not deserve any punishment.
What if we know that he's guilty? What if we know that he has? And of course, this is all theoretical. We're talking in the realm of the theoretical here, but I guess that's where I want you to go. Is it still wrong in all situations?
Well, I think that there may be cases, and I mentioned before, there may be cases where, say, to prevent a nuclear war, you could justify the deliberate murder of an innocent person, right? Then at least when you could make a case for that. But has this ever happened? Is it ever likely to happen? Would that mean that murdering the innocent persons should be legal, or that it should be written into the legislation that you can do it in this cases and that cases?
And you would say no.
No, certainly not.
Let's take one more call. We have Vincent on the line from downtown. Vincent, go ahead and do keep it brief.
Yes, first of all, I'd like to say thank you. Very good subject. And I'll just make this very brief. Torture, and the reason I want to point this out is
Vincent, did you say, Vincent, I'm sorry to stop you, your cell phone was a little funky there. Did you say that you're pro-torture?
Yes, I think we should be allowed to use torture wherever it's necessary to abstract any kind of information that will obviously give us the upper hand and the advantage to our situation. The problem here is I think your guest speakers are forgetting that the terrorists don't care who they kill. They don't care if they blow up innocent women and children, whether or not they're Americans, Arabs, whoever the case may be. They don't care. So the way we need to look at this is that do you think that your guests would have a different point of view if they were on the other edge of a sword and about to lose their heads?
Thank you very much.
I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Vincent. Who wants to have the last word?
I would just raise the question of how many thousands or millions of people should be tortured to find one who's guilty or one who has information. If, in fact, it were efficacious to torture people to get information, and we don't know if they have the information to start with, we would have to torture literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and thousands of innocent people in order to discover one person who has any such information. Most military officers, in public and in private, do not believe most of the time you get good intelligence from torture.
And we'll have to leave it at that. Let me remind folks that San Diego State University's teach-in entitled Historical, Political, and Moral Dimensions of U.S. Torture Policy begins at 3 p.m. today at SDSU's Nassiter Hall, room 100. It's free and open to the public. Carol Kennedy is a professor of political science at San Diego State. Carol, thank you.
Thank you.
And Brian Loveman is a professor of political science and past Fred J. Hansen Chair for Peace Studies at SDSU. Brian, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for the invitation again.
And last but not least, Tom Weston is a professor of logic, ethics, and political philosophy at San Diego State. And Tom, thanks.
Thank you.